der Design-Podcast der Burg.
Welcome to another episode of the Hurra Hurra Podcast. This is number 38 already. Every time I have to look up what number we are on right now, and I'm always very happy that we already made so many episodes. And as you hear right now, this one is again in English language, because our guest today is Raphael de Courville. And to introduce him a bit more, I know Raphael since, I guess, 2014, and he was popping into my life a way that he was a part of the Retune Festival team back in 2014, where we all together helped Julian Adenauer, who was in the podcast as well a few episodes ago, to make this a great happening. And yeah, from that on, our path has crossed, and he is he's a great creative code enthusiast, working on many levels, all about related on design, art, and technologies. And long story short, hello, Raphael.
Hello. Very nice to be here. Thanks for inviting.
Yeah, I catched you right now while drinking. So, and Raphael, you're not in we are not sharing the same physical space right now. You're in Berlin and I'm here in Dresden. And you're very professional, equipped with a very good microphone. You are a professional one because you are doing a lot of streaming on Twitch on Creative Code. But before we talk about that, can you just tell us a bit more about who you are, because it's so difficult to find proper informations, reliable informations on your person and on your activities.
Yeah, well, I can try. Mm-hmm.
I will correct
you. So yeah, I'm Raphael de Courville. I originally come from Paris, France. I grew up there and studied there. Mostly I studied graphic design originally, and then went into typography. So I was very much studying the, you know, traditional visual design, and wasn't so involved with digital stuff initially. And then I got into media arts and interactive installations and generative art relatively late. In 2012, I started learning processing. And that's also when I moved to Berlin. So all that happened in a pretty quick, like in 1 year, I sort of, my life really went from the traditional graphic design to generative art and generative design relatively quickly. I really fell in love with processing in 2012. I went to a workshop in Paris, Processing Paris, which used to be happening every year, a weekend workshop. And I learned with Julien Vega, Julien Gachadoa, who is also a very a prominent creative coder. And yeah, he really showed us how to use the basics. It was a basic introduction workshop, and I really enjoyed that. And that was a pivotal moment for me. And then in Berlin, I was doing sort of my own projects for about a year at that point. I took a sabbatical. I tried to learn German, but obviously you can tell by the fact that this podcast episode is in English, this wasn't as successful as I might have hoped. And then I started working for a little company in Berlin called App+Com, you may have heard of.
A little company.
So, yeah. A little company. So yeah, I was extremely lucky to work with Joachim Sauter at the time. And not for the whole time, just on a few, one or two projects, but that was really wonderful. I also worked in the research team there, doing some research and development, and also some projects in collaboration with academia and industrial partners on kind of research grants. And I also led an innovation and prototyping studio. That was the last thing I did there. Toward like the last 6 months I was there, I led this pilot project called App+Com Explore, which was running at the Hungarian Cultural Center in Berlin, of all places, just because Joachim was friends with the director there, and they could get us a room. And we had a lot of fun trying out some interaction, designing some new interactions between mobile devices and spaces. That was the mandate that we got. And after that, I left. I co-founded with Rafael Moko Schiller and Javier Soto Studio Noi, which we had the chance to have you and some of the students as visitors a couple times. And and I left Noi in August last year, so it's been about a year now that I parted with Noi. We're still very good friends. But I decided to go and do my own thing. And that's what I've been doing until now. And that's a very, very short summary of my whole life, I guess.
Okay, and, well, starting
yeah, we'll talk about the more recent stuff. Yeah, we'll talk about the more recent stuff. I wasn't born in 2012. I had a life before that.
You came to life and then went directly into processing.
Exactly. My life started when I discovered processing is basically the message here.
Yeah. But that what I really want to hook on a bit. As you said, like it totally got you processing in that workshop. But what was it that really inspired you? Because as you said, you came from a very analog, or of course you used InDesign, TypeLab, whatever for your works, but then processing got you. What was it that made it so special for you?
Well, I had been working together with a friend, Roman Miletic, who's now also a digital artist, doing some wonderful installation projects and virtual reality stuff, and still a very good friend. And we were collaborating. We had I failed to mention that earlier, but we had co-founded an art duo. We were doing media installations, so before 2012, together. And he was coding in C and C++ and tried to teach me a little bit, and that was extremely painful. an extremely painful experience, not for any fault of his own, but just because C++ is hard. So I didn't feel like I could be independent or write my own code or do anything by myself. I always had to ask him for help. And like going from this to processing, just open it and press play, was quite a revolutionary experience. But to go back a bit earlier and why I was excited about digital art in the first place, I was part of a research project called Gestural Script at the university, or not the university, the School of Design in Amiens, ESAD. I think the name has changed now, but it was ESAD Amiens. And we were researching, it was an interdisciplinary project between linguists and designers and typographers to come up with a writing system for sign language, for French sign language specifically. And one of the approaches that we were thinking about was, how do you represent, was the iconic and the gestural and almost graphical nature of sign language, and I'm gesturing right now, but you can't see that, the hands are moving through the space and they're leaving intangible trace in 3D space. And this would have been much easier to explain if Tilt Brush and all these other 3D painting programs existed at the time, but they didn't, and VR wasn't a thing. And so we decided to build something that was almost like a proto Tilt Brush, and that was very much like a proto Tilt Brush, with our own tracking, like 3D tracking device. There was like not much. The Kinect didn't exist. There was the Wiimote, but it wasn't that precise. And so I asked my friend Roman if he would be able to tell us how plausible it would be to build something like this that would represent or give us a representation of the motion of hands in 3D space in a computer. And he was so interested by the challenge that he joined the team. And then we started working together within that research project. And through this research, we sort of realized that, but you could make this installation into an art installation, this device, this system into an art installation. And we got the chance through the school, through the director of the school, Barbara Denis, got us, we were very lucky to be invited to several festivals through the school. And yeah, that was my first contact with interactive media installations and seeing how an audience reacts to something you made like this. That was extremely gratifying. And I got hooked on that feeling of, you know, making something and seeing people respond to it and seeing the smiles and the enthusiasm. And that was really the high that I got chasing after that, I guess. And, you know, also this naive idea that this is a completely fresh and unexplored territory, because somehow it's not general knowledge that digital art and computer art started in the 60s. So yeah, it felt completely new, and we were going to be the pioneers of a new genre of art. That lasted for about a year before I discovered that was not the case. But yeah, I guess it's nice because it gave me motivation to learn more at the beginning.
Yeah, I see that as a very interesting point, that that it needs that kind of personal inauguration, that there is somebody taking you in into that context, because as a designer per se, you're not super, let's say, how do you say it? Like, you're not always in touch with like deep coding or creative coding or whatever IT things are. It's like, okay, I have to get my router done. I have to see where I put my installation file on my thing to get Illustrator running well, or to have to patch something because I don't want to pay for the software. But when it comes to productive or progressive use of code for designerly or artistic means, that is something with that has a very high access level. As a layperson, it always needs somebody taking you in. And I think that, as you say, and that what I see as an experience from my personal life, but also when I see it from friends, colleagues, students, that it also needs that sort of project context, that, okay, why should I do that? Just learning it because for the sake of it is something that is really, really enduring, because it takes so much discipline and so much shift of, I would say, expertise, because that program thinking that is a bit opposite to the way of artistic thinking. Like, there is this, okay, I can reimagine things. I can take things out of context and place it into another place, and there is some sort of ambiguity in it. But if you just forget a semicolon in processing, it's not working. So there is no interpretation. It's just you have to put it there, and if it's not there, it's not working. And that is something, if you have a reason for going for that, it's easier than just doing it from scratch. I want to learn it because I want to have that expertise. In my eyes, yeah, I see it in your thing too.
Yeah, I think nowadays there are so many different tools, and some of them are more forgiving than others. I think something like processing or P5.js, they are sure that you can still, you know, miss a semicolon, or, well, not in P5, but yeah, you can still make one character or be one character off and it doesn't work. But then, yeah, some people like to use Touch Designer or other more visual programming environments. And those, I suppose, because I haven't really used Touch Designer that much, but it might be a little bit easier for visually minded people to get into. There's definitely, when you use code as part of your medium, there is a certain level of abstract thinking that you have to put in. The code runs on your brain before it runs on the computer, basically. You have to have some kind of idea of the structure of the machine that you're building before you start building it, or while you build it, you update this mental model of what it is that you're building, because the computer doesn't really give you that meta level of information about the code you're writing. Which is a little bit different if you're using Touch Designer or VVVV or some node-based programming environment like the one that is in Spark AR, for example, mm-hmm. to make Instagram filters is also node-based. And then you have this graph of classes and objects and things that is visually present. And that might be a bit easier for some designers to get into, I suppose. I have to say that, to be perfectly honest, I was also fascinated with technology and computers from a young age. So it's not like, you know, I completely discovered coding in 2012 with processing or before that with my friend and C++. I did a little bit of coding on a Casio calculator back in 1999. And that was kind of my first discovery of programming. And before that, I was always fascinated with computers, but never really had the moment where somebody would have told me that programming was a thing and that I could learn. And I felt strongly that it was a bit of a missed opportunity, because I think I was a very nerdy kid and I would have really enjoyed programming when I was younger. But yeah, it just didn't happen. So yeah, I'm catching up now, basically, with friends of mine who started coding at the age of 6, like Abe Passos of Fun Programming. He was a whiz kid. A wonder kid, I can't get an edge technically, but I guess I bring my designer mindset and experience in the field, and that's mm-hmm. helpful.
And that's interesting that you say that, because now you are sharing your coding knowledge and your expertise in. You used to do it as a real person meetups and for the Creative Coach Stammtisch in Berlin, but through the whole Corona pandemic, you moved it to Twitch, where you do also the Creative Code sessions. Can you tell a bit more about what brought you to the Creative Coach Stammtisch and how it moved to Twitch, and what are you doing on Twitch there?
So I will have to correct you a little bit on this, because we have so the Creative Code meetups of Creative Code Berlin mm-hmm. were started in late 2012. So soon after I moved to Berlin, we started these meetups thanks to Rachel Uwa, who then went on to start the School of Machines Making and Make Believe. I don't know if you talked to her already on the podcast, but
I did. It's episode should. Number 6, I guess.
Wonderful. Yeah. So she's somebody I have a huge amount of respect for, mm-hmm. and
everyone.
And I love what she's doing with the school. Yeah, absolutely. And everybody should go and do a program at the School of Machines. So Rachel in 2012, I met through Open Tech School, and mm-hmm. She suggested that we do a workshop that was something called like Math for Artists or something like this, I think was the topic. And she brought together Ramin Soleimani, Abe Passos, and myself, and we each gave one workshop. And I think I was showing 3D in processing or something like this. And we really enjoyed doing this together. It was already at Co-op, the place where we've been doing the meetups in real space after that, all these years. Basically we said, well, why don't we have this be a regular thing, you know, how it goes. So yeah, we started doing it as a regular meetup. It was processing. First it was processing code jam. Which was inspired by my experience at the Berlin Mini Game Jam, which I had a lot of fun at a few times, and building games over the course of one day. And we thought, hey, why not have something like that for creative coding? So that was the first thing, processing code jam. And then soon after, or some months after, we decided to, first of all, have it be more regular, so once a month, and also change the name to Creative Code Jam so that it would be more inclusive. And I don't remember the exact timeline, but we also started the Creative Code Stammtisch, which is more of a show and tell format where the jam is more hands-on. So we have those two meetups, and this is still the case, though we had to move them online. So now they're still happening, but online. Though there are a lot of voices asking for the return of the physical meetups, and we're working on it. But it's been nice to move it online, because we also now have a lot of people coming from other places who wouldn't never be able to attend the physical meetup in Berlin because they live in Canada or in India or somewhere else. And it would be a shame to lose that. But also, I don't think that hybrid meetups are really a good option. So
no, yeah, that's never an ongoing really discussion.
I don't think so. So what did I mean to say? So this the meetups are one thing, and then Twitch is something I started in February. I had been wanting to make video tutorials for a long time, and I participated in a program online called the Hyperlink Academy. I was their first cohort, and it was about developing one project that you'd been, you know, procrastinating for a while, and you needed a bit of peer pressure to do. So, yeah, I brought a cohort together, and everybody had a different project. It was quite nice. And yeah, my project was making video tutorials for creative coding on YouTube, and I got slightly sidetracked, and I started a Twitch channel. And in the end, I never made a single tutorial on YouTube. It might still happen in the future. I still want to do that, but I was getting, yeah, kind of scared of the idea of making something permanent, and somehow Twitch felt more similar to what I knew how to do with the meetups, you know, just talk and welcome people and comment on various people's code, maybe do some live coding. So yeah, that's what I do on Twitch, and it's not directly connected, besides the fact that it's me as well, to Creative Code Berlin. I want to keep that distinction as clear as I can, even though I think for some people it's not that clear, as evident by your introduction. Yeah. And that's entirely my fault, because I haven't made that clear enough. But it's a little bit tricky to do. So yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, but yeah, I understand. Just to be fair on credits and stuff, but because it's rotating around the same or similar topics, it's that impression is it comes very near. But what I find very interesting is that you why do you prefer Twitch? Is that you can engage with the community in real time? That is different to producing something baked in YouTube. And my question, and that is one ambition, or like why I wanted to have you for that conversation, is because that podcast is about design education, and we moved so much the whole design teaching, also art teaching, all the other universities did that too, to online classes due to the pandemic situation of COVID-19. And we all tried our best. Not everybody, I would say everybody tried their best, not everybody reached their best, because it's complicated and not everybody is that fluent digital and in a way, and with all the personal struggles everyone had during that exceptional state during the corona pandemic. I find it very interesting that how you do it, because you have that challenge to all the Twitch sessions. You're very engaging with that. There is it's just you on the screen. It's not that you have that Zoom window where everybody is present. So what do you think can, I call them regular institutions like art schools, design schools, schools in just in any case, or educational institutions from not from you, maybe also from you, but from activists or persons like you being active on Twitch? What is so special about it? What kind of super pro argument is there to do things rather on Twitch than on other platforms?
That's tough, because I never fully think about what I do as education. I really see it as entertainment. And
it's sit there and I was like, okay, stop. no, stop. So it's super interesting. So I see it as maybe it's not education, but training, or let's not talk about education as a term.
Yeah, I'm I mean, you know, I think entertainment is often seen as a dirty word, but especially, I don't know, I've been, you know, working with museums for some years, and yeah, a lot of people in museums don't like the word entertainment. I gave a talk about that recently. Well, yeah, last year. But yeah, it's, I think you learn best when you're, you know, when you're engaged with the material, and making it entertaining is, you know, it's no secret. It just makes people more interested. And so, yeah, I tend to try to make it funny. I go on rambly tangents about completely unrelated topics, and people never know exactly what I'm going to say. So, yeah, I guess that's part of what people like who watch the stream, and I react to what they say. So it's also, you know, it's interactive in that way, even though I can't see their faces. And yeah, I try to make it as fun as I possibly can. And, you know, I'm a big fan of comedy, and I try to, you know, do my personal brand of awkward nerdy comedy, which is embedded in the streams. I don't know how funny I really am, but some people laugh, so that's that makes me happy. And yeah, that's, I try to have fun with the material basically, and I have people in the community, like this French young guy called Shinif, who's I think he's still in school, and he's always trying to troll me with his submissions to the challenge. Like the last time he put a link in there, and I go there, and it's a stick figure, dancing stick figure in Processing Editor with my face on it, and a big text saying, "You've got raft." And that was just like, you know, typical sort of Rickroll style thing. But I really didn't expect it. And so, yeah, it was funny. And also it makes me really happy to see the community sort of, yeah, playing with me. And so it's becoming this sort of little game where they're trying to surprise me with their comments or putting jokes in the code. And yeah, that's the part of it that I didn't expect that really makes me super happy to see. That and the fact that the community also lives on Discord, because, you know, that's the way it works. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
now, explain that, just because you say that's the way it works, like, yeah, streamers have
on Twitch,
Discord.
Yeah. So most Twitch streamers, if you look at a tutorial like, hey, how to get started on Twitch, like the first thing you see is, okay, make a Discord, which I don't know if that's really necessary for everybody, but that's the thing that Twitch streamers, people who do, you know, Let's Play streams, mm-hmm. Where they play video games for an audience, is a thing. And I think people requested it quite early on as well for me, that they wanted to know if there was a Discord server, because they want to engage with each other outside of the time when I'm live, because I'm live on Tuesdays and Sundays, and during that time they can talk to each other in the chat or talk to me, but they also want to be able to engage with each other as a community outside of that time, and that's what the Discord is for. So Discord is like a forum. If you've never used Discord, it's basically like Slack, but it's, I think it was inspired by Slack, though I think some younger people called Slack the Discord for boomers, but Slack came first. I think Slack came first, but Discord is really strong in the,
like, boomers. Boomers came there now. First too.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, the Discord is very much used in the gaming community. That's where it comes from. But now it's expanded, and I think you know, most people under the age of 25 are using Discord one way or another. But yeah, so I made this Discord server, and there are a bunch of channels. The one for the Creative Code Challenge, where people send their submissions for the weekly Creative Coding Challenge, and we vote for the topic. So the community is voting for the topic. And yeah, the other thing that I really liked, that was also a development that I didn't entirely foresee, is that now people are talking to each other on the Discord, and they're helping each other. So people have questions and others answer them. And they show their projects, and others are hyping them up. And it's just such a fantastic feeling to see, you know, and I don't have to be there. So they sort of put like bring their own life and their own experiments and their own art to the community server and engage with each other. And yeah, I hope this continues for as long as possible. I know that when a community grows to a certain number, then you know people individually become more anonymous, and it's easier to have trolls and people disrupting things. But I think the only thing you can do is to infuse a certain spirit into the community by example, and that's what I do during the streams, and by maybe setting a code of conduct and things like that. And so that's yeah. Hopefully that can still support this. They can still support this spirit of community when it grows to a too larger number. But I'm not in a hurry to have it be too big, because it's a really nice phase when you have this small community and you know people by name. And yeah, I don't want it to end anytime soon. But let's
see. But when you talk about numbers, how many people are in the on the Discord server?
That's a good question. I should just roundabout check that. Yeah, it looks like we have about 380 people in the Discord. Yes, there's about 500 followers on Twitch. So it's nice. It's not huge numbers by any means, but yeah. And generally during the streams, we have between 15 and 25 people watching. So yeah, it's a small community. People know each other by name. I know them by name as well. We talk on we talk directly in DMs, and yeah, that's that feels really nice. I really enjoy that.
As you described what happens on the Discord server, because I'm not using Discord. I'm using Slack, and that's just because of what came first, and I'm trying to keep down the number of platforms where communications run in. And also, I'm not a big Twitch user, but what you described, what happens on the server is sounds for me like how a good project runs on in a design university as well. There is the professor comes in certain times, gives an input, is there, up for conversations, is available. I guess you are in the Discord server as well and give some hints here and there and just give some feedback and drop a meme. And then the participants or the contributors or the community works for itself. Like the students in a group share knowledge, give advice, ask questions, listen to music together, and get drunk in the afternoon. So that's something that sounds very familiar. And I guess through that, as you say, through that small number of people, it keeps that spirit and that as you called it, infused. Like you bring that in. Different to whatever, like in a real I want to stop saying real university, like on a university for technical whatever issues, where you have a lecture room with 600 people sit in and listen to a person standing in front of a huge chalkboard on a small podium and then going out anonymously. That is something like I watch a tutorial on YouTube. So that I find very interesting, that there is a possibility of, in my eyes, to see a comparison between those two real and digital ways of, okay, it's not education as you say, but transmitting knowledge from one side to the other.
Yeah, I mean, you can make this comparison. I don't know how far it goes, because I'm not bound by the demands of a faculty or an educational institution. There's no learning goals or anything like that. I don't give grades, and whether people learn or not is. You know, it's really on them, but that's also in a way their responsibility. And so I feel like, yeah, everybody's responsible for their own learning, and then people support each other. And I don't really come in the Discord to give feedback on people's work that much. I do sometimes, but it's quite rare. And I do it during the streams for sure. And I actually, I've tried recently to focus a little more of my feedback on the design and the visual and the conceptual aspect, and not only on the code, because in any case, you know, a lot of the people who participate in the challenge are better coder objectively than I am. They're professional, and I'm definitely not. I've never coded for money professionally. So I try to be a teacher in a way, but I don't know. I don't really identify with this. And yeah, in terms of education, I've been teaching in schools. I taught typography for 2 years to students who, for the most part, weren't exactly interested in the subject. First year students who were maybe, you know, wanting to go and study fashion design, and so they're like, well, typography is irrelevant to my my interests, and it might have been right. You know, I mean, I think you can learn a lot from typography or any subject for that matter. But yeah, it's not a great setup when you have the students who are in the class who aren't interested in the subject and didn't decide to study it. I'm not sure what the solution is, but yeah, the way that education is set up, and with grades and with obligatory lessons, and yeah, there's something flawed there. And I actually was thinking this year of spending more time teaching. And my first intuition was to go and reach out to all the people I know, including you, who are in schools, and say like, hey, you know, I want to give workshops. I'd like to give lessons, maybe get a regular visitor lecturer position. And I, you know, I might still do that given the right context and opportunity. I really enjoyed giving the workshop at Burg last year. That was super fun, and the students were great. But I also feel like sometimes working with the whole administration around the school is a lot of overhead that is getting in between you and your desire to transmit and transfer some knowledge, though knowledge transfer is also not the right paradigm for education, but yeah, to share your passion for the topic.
Yeah.
And that's why I sort of intuitively, and now I reflect on it back, and I'm like, well, but actually, you know, my desire to share my passion is better served by what I do on Twitch than it ever was in a classroom. So that checks that box for me this year. Whether it's sustainable financially is going to be another question, but that's a question for future me. And for now, I really enjoy what I'm doing and building a community around it. So yeah, that's something I would definitely encourage anyone who feels inclined to speak in front of a camera, which is a very awkward and weird thing to do, especially in the beginning when you have a few people in the chat.
Yeah, but it's similar with the whole podcasting thing. Like talking in that, it's a very asynchronous other than your Twitch thing, but also doing this. Okay, as I talk now, and one day another person will hear it, and well, hopefully they don't really see that I'm totally unprepared. Just overplay that with humor. Okay.
Maybe they enjoy it.
Yeah.
Maybe they appreciate the unpreparedness and the, you know, spontaneous improvisational tone. That's what I do with Twitch, you know. And some people watch the replay, watch the VOD. I embrace the awkwardness completely. I know I'm awkward and nerdy, and that's kind of funny. You know, now I have a very self-deprecative, or you know, I like to laugh about myself, and so that's part of the brand in a way. That, you know, I'm gonna go on a weird sentence. I don't know where it's going, and I'll just keep going and pushing it beyond the point where it's a normal person would stop. Really. So yeah, you know, I guess I share a bit of that with somebody like Daniel Schiffman, though I'm mm-hmm. trying to not just, you know, like be a knockoff Aldi brand Daniel Schiffman.
Yeah. Daniel Schiffman, but, yeah, great so person. Yeah,
he's amazing.
Yeah,
the coding train is the best. And you know, I'm looking at what Daniel Schiffman does. If we're talking about education, to me, he's the best creative coding or coding teacher in the world. That I'm aware of. maybe there's someone better in a small school somewhere in Pakistan. I don't know, but he's amazing, and what he does on YouTube is beautiful, and he's brought so many people to coding, not only creative coding. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I feel like, you know, I've been thinking also because of these stories of making tutorials, and there's so many people, not only Daniel Schiffman, but people like Coding Mama or Shinshin on YouTube who are doing amazing tutorials about P5JS, and I don't know if I need to make more, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I'll make videos, but they might not be, okay, let's see how we can, you know, do arrays in P5 or whatever, because it's not my place, and they've done it already better than I ever could. So yeah, sometimes it's good to see, like, okay, what's already done and what's left. And I think, you know, more entertainment-based learning is something I can do that is... yeah, maybe less focused on specific topics and more focused about sharing the enthusiasm that I have for the subject and getting people excited about it and see that it's, you know, it doesn't have to be that serious, that you can have fun with it. If that's the learning, if that's the takeaway that people have, I'd be, you know, really, really happy with the results.
Yeah, and that
and if they learned a little bit of coding in the process, it's great, but that's not necessary.
Yeah, but it comes also with that what we had in the beginning, that it needs that personal inauguration that is very low access, that gives people the chance to just be part, just to sneak in and to see, oh, well, it's not that big. Okay, I stay in, and the complexity raises step by step, and it's not something that, okay, here is what we have to learn, and that is what has to be happening. If you don't reach it in that certain time, you get a bad grade, and that is something that is super, super bad. And super, super bad, that's the Trump word, but it's not what we want to go for. And what I see also, as you said, talk about Daniel Schiffman. I didn't have them on this on my screen for preparing for your talk, for our conversation, but also Daniel Schiffman was one person that I came along also in 2010 or something, when he was coming up with the Boyd algorithm for emergent systems, where you can have you can design a swarm of little particles and that reacts on distractors and attractors. And that was something, it was super well documented on the web. There were videos for that, and everybody could start using processing for creating the stuff. And it was before impossible to do so with Flash or whatever. So it was easy to do, and it was wonderful. And Daniel Schiffman really made a mark for many people to go into coding. Even I didn't went so far in coding. I understood how it works, and that I get a kind of a communicative expertise in talking to coders. That is something that helped as well. And there also, that one thing that is about the spirit is that all processing is open, so everybody can use it, and is also that sharing idea behind it is something that now also comes with all the activists and people using it, is also their idea of sharing their knowledge and not keeping it for themselves. And the way of doing it is, okay, there are people just like dropping knowledge and putting it on YouTube, and others are just like getting people into that way of doing things as you do. But because I'm just looking a bit on the time, and there is this other thing, and you say, okay, as you said, that there is the question, is that financially stable to not go to schools to teach there, to bring your, I just stick to the term, to your knowledge to other peoples. There is another way how to earn money, and there was this one tweet from yourself just recently where that said, hey mom, I pay my rent by selling gifts on the internet, and I want to ask, is that true?
Oh, so So the tweet was actually it's actually a sort of meme NFT that I put out, which was the exact text was I made rent selling gifts on the internet. How do I explain this to my parents?
Okay.
Which was basically my feeling after the first weekend that I spent on Hiketnunk. Hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was technically true. I still have to figure out the tax situation, but it was technically true, and now it's factually true. I need to qualify this. I was on Hiketnunk during already on the first week, thanks to Joanie Le Mercier who talked about it.
Stop, Raphael. We have to just make a little excourse. What we are now talking about is non-fungible tokens. And non-fungible tokens is, you can explain that better, but there is a platform on where these non-fungible tokens are, I don't know, sold, like where you can get them. And this is the website Hiketnunk. And just a little editor's note from myself to get the people in what we are talking about. Keep going.
should I do an explanation?
Please.
Should I explain a bit what it is?
Please.
Let's see. So, there is a thing called cryptocurrencies.
As
which,
blockchain,
some people may have heard of and this all this stuff.
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin, Ethereum, all that stuff, which everybody's tired of hearing about, but it's necessary to explain what an NFT is. I usually hate to be the one explaining blockchain stuff, so I'm going to force myself, but it's annoying. But basically, it's this form of database that is a distributed database online that stores information. And you can store any kind of information, like who owns what, but you can also store information, like who owns what art. And what works for a currency works for JPEGs. There's a register online and in a distributed fashion in this sort of blockchain database that says this person owns one edition of that JPEG or GIF or something else. We'll get to it. So this is basically an agreement, a consensus between all the people involved in the system to say that this person spent an amount of this virtual money to buy this virtual good. In this way, it's very similar to, if you buy a special skin in Fortnite or in PUBG, in those video games. People have been doing it for a long time. You know, they spend real world money to buy virtual items in a game. And in this case, you spend real money or virtual money that you bought with real money to buy a virtual good that has been made by an artist. And thus, you're supporting the artist as well. And you help them pay their rent and buy food so they can make more art, hopefully. So that's the... in this way, it's kind of... it's quite similar to something like Patreon, where you're going to support the work of an artist and get the counterpart. In this case, the counterpart is a virtual good that you can resell later for hopefully a higher amount of money. And that's what a lot of people are speculating on. And this comes with controversial problems. Like, the speculative aspect can be a problem. There's people who just buy so they can flip it at a higher price later. And, they still support the artist, but it might make it very volatile so that, people are just hyping up an artist so they can sell it for higher. But this has also happened in the art market for years, and that the art market is more broken in a way because the original artist doesn't even get royalties for the higher price later, which you do on these platforms. You get a cut of resales as well as secondary sales. So there is an incentive for collectors somehow to also, you know, support you longer term, so that hopefully your work gets more valuable and then everybody wins from it. But it's not all, you know, it's not all necessarily rosy as well. The whole cryptocurrency I'm very critical of as well. It's a tool and you can use it to do anything, but it's also a tool that has ideological grounds that are problematic, and I've heard people criticize it pretty strongly in pretty strong words. There's been a lot of controversy around cryptocurrency and NFTs in particular. And it's twofold. One of the issues is the environmental issue. The cryptocurrencies like Ethereum or Bitcoin are causing a huge amount of electricity to be consumed just to make them work. And that's just part of the way that they are structured, that for every transaction, you need to expend a certain amount of calculations of computing power, which in turn consumes an electricity, which in turn releases CO2 in the atmosphere. There are various ways to calculate how much CO2 is released, and actually someone called Memo Acten, who happens to be also a media artist, but a researcher and AI expert, made a thread back in September last year. Well, a year ago. Yeah, it was in September, I think, end of September last year, made a thread on Twitter saying like, hey, what is going on? How are we, like, we're negating all the efforts that we're making in other parts by just exchanging these tokens. What's up with that? And that created the whole sort of backlash against NFT for environmental reasons. And Joanie Lemercier, who is an art activist, also very engaged with question of environmentalism and fighting against coal mining in Germany. He lives in Belgium, but he's been also close with the activists at the Hambach forest and fighting against the largest coal mine in Europe to try to get it to shut down and stop raising villages to expand the mine. You can see that all of that on his Twitter account, Joanie Lemercier. And so I was following these people and the whole discourse around it. Joanie wrote a few articles. And then I was quite surprised to see in March that Joanie was actually getting into this platform we talked about, Hiketnung. We had some conversations privately as well, and he was looking for these, he was saying like, yeah, there are these new platforms that are coming out that don't consume this large amount of electricity. They're more like, you know, you publish an NFT, it's like publishing a tweet. So I was thinking, well, if, you know, if Hiketnunk is good enough for Joanie, who is like this super vocal environmental activist, then it's good enough for me, because I had been holding off. I didn't want to go on the Ethereum platforms because, yeah, I was reading what everybody was saying and thinking, yeah, that no way, this is ridiculous amount of CO2 released. I won't be doing it. I actually signed up, I think, on one of those on Rarible or something like this. But I never published anything because that's when the whole backlash happened. And I signed up on Hiketnunk on the first, when it opened. And I started publishing my work there and starting making sales almost immediately. And I got quite involved in the community as well. Hiketnunk was started by this guy, Rafael Lima, in Brazil. And he's this very strange guy, but quite
positively
interesting.
Strange or weird strange? Kim.com strange, Elon Musk strange, or us strange?
He's his own brand of strange. there's nothing like it. He's like, you know, a sort of strange riddle god that speaks in riddles, and you can't really understand what he's saying, but people interpret it in the way that they that goes in their direction. It's very weird. But yeah, the platform itself is also extremely weird, and it feels like the early days of the internet. Mm-hmm. It's this, the UI doesn't make any sense. It's broken very often. So I'm not making a, you know, I'm not selling it very well, but I'm not trying to. Because yeah, it's sort of the punk bar of the NFT of NFT Street. There are these fancy stores. There's, you know, Rarible and Foundation and all these Ethereum platform, and Hiketnunk is like the second biggest in amount of transactions, but it's like unusable for many people because of how weird the UI is. It has a really kind of steep learning curve, and sometimes it just breaks for 2 weeks, and that's it. You just have to wait for it to come back online. That happened. Well, that happened once, to be fair. But yeah, it did happen. It was closed for 2 weeks. Though I have to say, thanks to the hard work of the people in the Silicon Valley, now Hiketnunk is just as stable as Facebook. So that's.
Good. Facebook just closed down yesterday. Was it yesterday?
yeah, that's what I mean. Okay. So the Hiketnunk is kind of interesting for its community. I would say that's what most people who have tried other platforms, and I haven't, so I can't. I am only saying what I've heard, but that's how tight and helpful the community is something very special on Hiketnunk, and that might be because of how strange and difficult to use the website is. So people stick together and they help each other. But yeah, that's what I found. Lots of people from many different countries are finding a way to make a living on this platform. Artists from Malaysia, from Argentina, from also all parts of the world. There's a big Filipino community as well, and people build all sorts of other platforms that rely on Hiketnunk as their central hub, but are, you know, different kinds of tools. And there's Hen Radio that is for musicians to publish their music and sell it. It's a very vibrant community. It's impossible to summarize in just a minute, but what I found there is a way to sustain myself by publishing my work and have collectors who actually like the art. I know I've heard a lot of criticism saying that it's only speculation, but that's not true. There's collectors I've been talking to who actually, you know, and in any case, you know, you can throw a lot of money at everything and buy everything and hope to make a profit. But I think in the art market, you have to like the art and you have to know what you're buying. Mm-hmm. And I've also been making a lot of posts on Twitter and try to educate collectors as well about the history of computer art, because I feel like it will give them an edge if they are able to recognize what is an original piece of digital art from what is just like somebody followed a tutorial and made 100 variations of the same thing, or they got some code from GitHub from someone else and published that as their NFT project, which unfortunately has happened. I think collectors need to know more and educate their own eye to recognize what is special and also make their own taste, because it is subjective to a large extent, but that they can recognize what they like and they can build a consistent collection, something that makes sense and that they will still like in 10 years from now. So,
but how do I have to imagine like their collection? This is something that is very difficult to me to feel into a collector of digital art, of people buying things images, whatever, files, data on Hiketnunk. Do they have a screen in their home where this piece is displayed? Do they have it in a folder on their Mac whenever they need a kind of aesthetic stimulation? They flip through that through these images, which they also could have just have had screenshotted. There's something that is that comes that I don't understand as a, let's say, in a use or in the use of art as use is a different word, I don't really get to a better one, but then also, is there a conflict in between that kind of open sourceness spirit that we have regarding the tools that we use for coding, but then producing things that can be possessed in a way that the whatever Van Gogh can be possessed. So is it, you know, this is something that is, I don't have an opinion on that. I just so have what, a weird so what feeling. You're,
yeah. So what you're saying is that there's not enough ownership in the in the NFT world. It should be more capitalistic. We should own the art more.
No, the question is why should I own this? You know, this is something that it's on the
it's
web.
It's part of an experience, really. I think that first of all, yes, people have a collection on the website. They can see it, or they can, you know, see it on another kind of service that would make a nice gallery out of what they own, or maybe they will see it in a metaverse, in VR. Mm-hmm. Some people like that. I'm actually very, very strong VR enthusiast, but I haven't gotten that much in the metaverse NFTs, but why not? You know, it's cool. Some people like to experience it this way. Some people do have digital art frames. I personally would really like to have more of that in my place so I can see my own collection. I'm waiting for a square OLED to come out. That would be perfect, because a lot of people do square formats on these platforms. I do as well. But anyway, I feel like people like the experience of saying, being able to say, like, hey, you know, I supported this artist by purchasing this. They might not say it this way, but that's part of the experience, and being able to, it is like any, well, as part at least of the fact of buying work. If you have a collection of paintings and sculptures in your fancy condo, you
as
invite people over to drink
to this podcast.
Yes, everybody. But you know, I've met these people. I grew up in a town where a lot of people were quite wealthy, and some of my friends had wealthy parents, and so I would go to their house, and they have this art hanging on the walls, and there's a Rothko there, and you're like, oh wow, okay, but. Of course they buy it because they like the art, but also there is obviously a part of it that is a symbol of your own wealth. So when you invite people over to have wine, they will see a Rothko and say, oh wow, they bought a Rothko. And that's, you know, it's silly, but it's always been part of this. It's like flaunting your wealth.
But what I want to
some, in some way. And what I'm getting at is people do the same, but it's on Twitter. So they're just like changing their profile picture to this work that they bought from an artist, from Manoloide or someone else. And then people see that, you know, they're part of this community and they bought this work, and or they tweet about it, like, hey, look, this cool work that this person did, and I just got one. So yeah, it is also for clout in a way, to show other collectors what your collection is like. And the fact that it doesn't have a physical entity to support it doesn't really make a difference, honestly. It's just, it just serves the same purpose. You enjoy the work, you enjoy the visual aspect of it, and you enjoy showing others that you have this taste. It is a form of cultural capital as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's an article I really like from Disuke Suematsu from 2014, I believe, that is called Why Fine Arts Cannot Be Culturally Relevant Anymore. I think the title is a little bit wonky, but yeah, but the article is beautiful. And it talks about the fact that fine arts has been, you know, in the contemporary art world, which is fairly recent, you know, started what, in the 50s or so. So this, at least the 20th century, right? That wasn't really a thing, the art market and as we know it today. So this whole concept of buying the work to show your wealth, and he talks about it as being a way for the super rich to convert their financial capital into cultural capital, because they have one and they lack the other. And work that gets produced within the art market is work that can function as this medium of exchange. I'm almost quoting literally from the article. And the problem that Disuke Sumatsu was already identifying in 2014 was that for digital art, which is infinitely reproducible, it's not able to function as this medium of exchange, and therefore it's not valued. And I feel like as digital artists and computer artists, we've been trained to think that our work is worthless because it is living in a computer. And honestly, for the last 6 months, I've been on a radical journey of unlearning this thing. Because finally, it feels like after, and for me, it's a decade. For some people, it's longer. Like there's people in Hiketnung who have been doing digital art for more than 20 years. And it's the first time in their career that somebody says like, oh, I love your work, I would buy it. And which is an experience that for a lot of more traditional artists is feels normal because their work lives in the physical world. And yeah, it's a big change, but I think for, you know, it's just the way that it should have been from the start, from the 60s. And some people had experimented with this, like, Rafael Rosenthal was selling you know, websites, selling the address to the website, the ownership of the URL, but with a contract and all of that. But you know, conceptual art and art that was intangible also been around for a long time. It's, you know, digital art generative art inherits from abstract art, and digital art in general is an instance of conceptual art. So, you know, it's not really new. If you look at the stuff that somebody like Klein was doing, they were selling it, what was it, like a certificate that is the experience of destroying the certificate. And so you buy it, and then the artwork is when you burn it, the feeling that you have left when you have burned that token, the piece of paper that he sold you as an artwork. And that was, what, in the 60s? So... Yeah. You know, there's been experiments that were going in much more radical direction than what we're doing with NFTs already for decades. It's just that now it's sort of formalized within this context that brings with it a lot of baggage of the whole cryptocurrency world that I'm personally not a fan of. I would love it if it didn't have this hyper crypto anarchist, anarcho-liberal capitalism attached to it. But I feel like, in a way, the fact that we're bringing artists within this world, maybe and hopefully, I am hopeful that it can act as a form of a Trojan horse to bring different values to the scene. That would be my hope. And because artists, I think maybe the crypto dudes of the world haven't realized the power that artists have to change the discourse and to, you know, be as a huge PR machine. For values that are typically going probably more to the left than what the typical crypto people are. So I feel like the needle might move thanks to things like Hiketnung, which is definitely this very sort of radical anti, sort of anti-establishment sort of platform. With very alternative artists. So that's how I feel about it. I'm willing to reassess this in a year or two and see if I was completely naive about it and we got completely overpowered by big finance, and I will have to take the lessons from that. But at least for the time being, I feel like it's empowering for a lot of artists, and it's enabling us to also make different kind of voices heard, and hopefully build on these technologies something a little better than Bitcoin and Ethereum.
That was very clear. Thanks, Rafael, for explaining that to a very deep level. But there's other one remark and one question. The first question is the support of artists through basically Hiketnung sales is something that you didn't talk about. You just mentioned it before, and then it was just off the screen, and I just want to bring it back. So. It's also something that, I don't know the English word, but it's maybe it's Patreon is the right word, but in Germany we have the word Mäzen, which is like a person that just buys art to support the artist. And is that something that is in there as well? So people just say, okay, wow, that is such a great piece of work related to a very great person behind it, because I can see the person through the art piece. I want to support this person to make more of that art, and that's why I'm buying that, because the share of, I wanted to say cash, the share of credit, financially credit, is bigger on Hicket Nunc that goes to the artist than when it goes to a gallery, where, I don't know, 50% plus taxes stay at the gallerist end. So that is something, is that something that is also as relevant as what you said on the let's say on the larger scale?
So there is definitely, like, when you sell on Hicket Nunc, you give 2.5% to the platform. So compared to what a gallery would take, it is insignificant. But you can also have royalties on your sales. And from what I talked about that with some other people who are more knowledgeable about the traditional art market, it's very rare that you can get royalties for resales. Mm-hmm. And even in the countries where it is a thing, I think in the UK, for example, you have to actively become aware that your work is being resold, and then go and tell, you know, the auction house that, hey, I'm the artist and I want my cut.
So it is good. Hey, I'm not the artist, a very automated process. I have a t-shirt out of that.
Yeah. So on most NFT platforms, there's a system of royalties and it's automated. So if somebody resells your work, then you get a cut. It's also the case that in the real, you know, in the traditional art market, I think, yeah, like 99.something% of the works never get a secondary, or 99.something% of artists never get secondary sales. So yeah, it's also not that common in NFT space. It is actually a pretty common thing. But one thing I want to say as well, since we're talking about cuts and money and stuff like that, is it's still very unclear, and that's something I've been researching with others, very unclear what the tax situation is in Germany in particular for this. And you know, I want to say that none of this is financial advice or an endorsement or trying to get people to go on Hicket Nunc. I think you should really do some research on this. I didn't really clarify the whole legal and tax wise thing before getting on it, and it looks quite complicated. So when I get to hear more about it, I will let people know on Twitter. But basically, somebody, Jack Rusher was summarizing this, a friend of mine who's also an artist on Hicket Nunc and German, was saying that, yeah, most, it, what he would say, yeah, it will be some time until the law catches up. And in the meantime, most tax advice will treat it as something it's not. And that's basically my experience with talking to tax advisors, is they just don't know. And so they do some pattern matching with the laws that they know, and it's like, oh, so you're selling a digital service, or oh, so you're selling a software, or your whatever, and what is it, how does
and
it work
where
with VAT?
Do you sell
you have
it?
To write
and who is
you have to write invoices for all these people, but all the buyers are anonymous, so how does that work? And that's a topic that nobody really wants to talk about, but we will have to. So I'm really trying to figure it out now, that should be a caveat for anybody getting into this. If you're doing this and you're converting your earnings to euros, or even if you don't, legally those are sales, so you owe tax in the amount of the exchange rate at the moment when you make the sale. So, you know, if it goes down to very small amount, then, well, you're still taxable in the moment of when you made the sale. So yeah, it's a complicated topic, and I can't really get into the details, but I wanted to mention it so that it doesn't seem like, oh yeah, it's magic internet money that you can make. And the other thing is, to go back to when I was saying I was there on the first week of Hiketnunk, I'm not sure exactly how the experiences of people who are getting on Hiketnunk now. I was lucky to be there at the beginning. And I've seen some artists also join in much later and still, you know, make some sales and do really well. But it's, you know, I think it's very possible that somebody gets on and doesn't make any sell. You know, if you want to experiment with it, have fun with it, just do it. But keep in mind that, first of all, it has a pretty steep learning curve. And second of all, you might struggle with your taxes afterwards.
I keep my comment for myself because I would look at the clock and it says we are way over time, but which is very great.
Oh,
no, that's all good, Rafael. It's perfect. Rafael, thank you a lot for sharing your ideas on edutainment, whatever we might call it, and that very
please don't call it edutainment.
I would do it. I just like it would be the headline for the podcast. An interview with the edutainer Raphael de Courville and with a very renowned and for the excourse in the NFT thing, and I'm very happy that it works for you. That is great and is creates a lot of joy in myself, and also that you are so discursive about it, and that is nothing that you take for granted, and that is something that you really try to get hold of and see all that various aspects related to it. That is very inspiring, and everybody should do it like this.
That's what artists have to do. I think we have artists to say stay critical of whatever it is we're engaging with. It's essential.
That's essential, and it's also essential to say goodbye and hit the red unrecord button. Thanks, Raphael. It was a great pleasure. Bye bye. Der Design-Podcast der Burg.